From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, we're going to talk some moon mysteries, but here's what's happening. More explosive devices reportedly turned up as police raided homes throughout Belgium in a desperate manhunt for a third suspect believed to have survived the morning's coordinated bombings in Brussels. We were on the air last night when this was happening there. At least 34 people killed. It's thought that the third bomber, his bomb did not go off, and then he took off. Included in the haul were several unexploded devices that police picked up. ISIS claimed credit for the twin rush hour attacks, one at the airport, the other at a metro station near the European Union headquarters. Just a very tragic situation there. And, of course, major U.S. cities deployed police in large numbers, some with heavy weapons patrolling transit hubs after at least these 34 people were killed in attacks on a Brussels airport and subway. Officials said that there was no evidence of specific threats to the United States. New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago stepped up their security, and major airlines scrambled resources to cope with closings at the airport in Belgium's capital. Jerome Corsi, of course, noted author with us, writes for WND.com. Jerry, this situation, I would suspect, is in retaliation for the arrest of Abdul Shasham, huh?
I think most likely that's right, George. The retaliation bombings, but also I think the fact that Belgian police were now going to conduct a more massive manhunt, and the fact that the one terrorist bombing from France was apprehended and would start talking may have upped the time clock for other terrorists who were planning attacks, saying, let's do them now before we're caught or before our plans are unveiled. So the apprehension of this prime suspect earlier this week might have triggered the other terrorists saying, let's act now.
You know, Jerry, I fly a lot, and there's really no security getting into the airport. Obviously, to get through to get to the plane, that's a different story. But to get into the airport, it's pretty open. You know that.
It's wide open. It's an unprotected area, certainly until you get to security, go through the security checkpoints, anyone can walk into the airport. In fact, it reminds me years ago of a terrorist attack when a group of terrorists with automatic weapons came into the airport in Rome, and the front section just killed randomly a whole group of people. This is one of the security breakdowns in terms of how airports function. But, you know, George, to actually screen anyone who's coming into an airport at all would take a massive reengineering of airports all over the world.
Everything would be clogged up, Jerry.
It would be a nightmare. I mean, I can't imagine how you really do it with even thinking automobiles coming in to be parked in an airport. Where do you really start checking people? But this is clearly an alarm for a section of all airports around the world that are unprotected.
And, Jerry, I was looking at pictures today of two of the suspected bombers wearing their one black glove on their hands. And, you know, just looking at their pictures, I'm saying to myself, these people actually know that they're going to blow themselves up in minutes, killing innocent people, taking their lives. Why? What's the purpose? There's something else going on here. This is not, you know, just fanatics talking about Islam and Muhammad. There's something else going on here, and I can't put my finger on it yet.
Well, George, it's certainly a bizarre phenomenon, because normal human beings, first of all, are not going to commit suicide with a mission to kill many others. I mean, the whole idea is to a rational person, and certainly as we think of it in the West, a rational person is insane. And it's chilling how calmly these terrorists in those photographs, you know, with a black glove, were coming into the airport, pushing carts, looking completely normal, when you know in their minds they were calculating where they could best kill the largest number and knowing in the process they would die. I mean, it was a chilling picture, thinking that these people so calmly were calculating death for others and themselves.
Really is. Jerry, let's stay in touch on this story, too, and let's keep our fingers crossed that nothing comes home. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton notched convincing victories tonight in Arizona, picking up the biggest prize of Western Tuesday and moving closer to their party nominations. Trump's victory, which hands him 58 Republican delegates, could make it harder for rivals Ted Cruz and John Kasich to slow his march toward the nomination. It also suggests that Trump's vow to deport undocumented migrants and to build a border wall resonated in the southwestern state, where illegal immigration is a very hot issue there. Now, Clinton's win, meanwhile, thwarted hopes from Bernie Sanders' campaign for an early morale boost after the Vermont senator drew a blank in five important contests across the Midwest and the South last week. Hillary Clinton is getting closer to the nomination, getting enough delegates. Trump, of course, and Cruz, you know, Trump is pulling away a little bit at a time, but Cruz is still there. Let's check in with Howard Bloom to get his take on tonight and also the weeks ahead. Howard, what do you think?
Well, it's the strangest election in your lifetime and mine, and it's getting even stranger. This morning we had the Brussels bombing. We had a terrorist bombing on the morning of primary elections in three states. That's Arizona, Idaho, and Utah. Before the bombings, a Rasmussen poll showed the concern about ISIS among voters was already extremely high. It was 50%. 50% wanted more done about Islamic terror before the bombings. And Republican voters were overwhelmingly for Donald Trump's plan of banning Muslims from immigrating to the USA. All that was before Brussels. In theory, Brussels should have increased that concern about Muslim terrorism. Now, strangely, yesterday, most of the candidates spoke to the pro-Israel lobbying group AIPAC, and they laid out their ideas on Islamic terrorism and a related topic, Iran. Bernie Sanders gave his speech on the subject by emailing it in, and only Donald Trump recognized that Muslim education often teaches hatred and violence. Oh, I mean, this is part of the mystery that you were just probing a second ago. Only Trump acknowledged that suicide bombers' families and the families of those who stab Israelis are paid for their families' members' sacrifice. And only Sanders recognized that when you topple a dictator, you get a power vacuum. And it's a vacuum of that kind that ISIS specializes in filling. So beware of toppling Bashar Assad. Only Sanders seemed to get that. Meanwhile, polls and the voting tallies are getting wildly out of sync. Trump and Hillary won Arizona. Cruz is still way behind Donald Trump, and Kasich is barely hanging in there when it comes to delegates, but on the Democratic side, there's a horse race in popularity, not in delegates, but in popularity. Sanders is now almost neck and neck with Hillary in popularity, 41% to 44%, and even stranger, Sanders would beat Donald Trump by 15% in a head-to-head competition. That was true 3 weeks ago when we discussed it. It's even more true now. Hillary would only best Trump by 10%, and Trump and Hillary have the highest unfavorability ratings in the history of the CBS New York Times poll. But the Republicans' secret weapon, hold on to your seat, is Kasich. Against Ted Cruz, Hillary would only win by 3%. But John Kasich, the candidate that most Republicans, according to polls,
who has only won one state
election, right, and most Republicans feel that he should drop out of the election. Only 24% still want him in the election, but he would beat Hillary by 4%. And finally, there's good news for the Democrats and bad news for the Republicans. 66% of voters are now unfavorable to Republicans. That's 66% unfavorable. Only 28% are favorable, but 46% are favorable to Democrats. So it's a wild and crazy election, and it's going to get even wilder.
All right, my friend. Love your analysis. A South Texas man has been charged in the death of his four-month-old son, whom he left in a hot car for at least 40 minutes last summer. Jail records show that the 22-year-old of Corpus Christi is being held on charges of criminally negligent homicide and abandoning or endangering the child. Folks, it's going to start getting hotter in the next few months as we get closer to summertime. Do not leave your animals and your children in a car locked up. Take them with you, please. Harrison Ford has said he did not want to star in a new Indiana Jones film without director Steven Spielberg. The actor is due to star in the fifth Indiana Jones film, which will be released in 2019. Ford says that, "I always thought there was an opportunity to do another, but I wanted to do it with Steven." And Steven is developing a script now, he says, that I think we're going to be very happy with. So here we go. Up next, we're going to talk about nature changes. It's called the Serengeti Rules, the quest to discover how life works and why it matters. Sean Carroll joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Our special guest, Sean B. Carroll, tonight. Sean is an award-winning scientist, writer, educator, executive producer. He is a professor of molecular biology and genetics at the University of Wisconsin and has written seven books. His newest book, of course, The Serengeti Rules, chronicles the rules that govern all life at all scales inside of our cells, bodies, you name it. Sean, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, George.
Looking forward to it. You got to tell me what the title means, The Serengeti Rules.
Well, the book was inspired by a trip to the Serengeti, and that's really our homeland as a species. And I think I was sort of witnessing firsthand the sort of way we lived hundreds of thousands of years ago. And it's just a touchstone, I think, for thinking about how nature works in general and how we're a part of nature all over the world right now.
And you come up with some interesting twists about the importance of wildlife, food chains in nature. Give us some examples here so we get a better perspective of this.
Well, I guess we'll probably talk a little bit about food chains, but let's take one right out of the headline. So Zika virus, now that has a lot of people concerned. How do we get in this situation? Well, it's kind of a long trip it's the Zika forest of Uganda, where that virus was first detected in 1947, really didn't make any noise and any concern in medical circles for probably 60 years or so. Now here it is turning up in Brazil, causing some really scary situations. Well, how does that virus get around the world? Well, we're really the transportation agent for these things because, you know, humans move around the world a lot, and a lot of creatures move with us, including things like mosquitoes. And the mosquito that's carrying Zika in South America actually isn't native to South America. We brought that over to South America.
We created that mosquito, didn't we?
Well, we brought it. I mean, lots of things have kind of come along as passengers as humans have moved around the world. And so that mosquito is not native, and it's looking for something to eat. And what better to eat than the most numerous mammal it can find for a blood meal? That's us. So we've essentially entered this mosquito's food chain instead of wildlife, and we've released viruses from the wild, like Zika, by human activity. And decades later, it shows up, you know, in metropolitan areas of South America, and you know, is now an acute health concern. So what we do, and it's, you know, it's just accidental on our part. It's just human beings being human beings. We are, you know, creating a lot of new combinations in nature. In this case, of virus that's being carried by a particular mosquito, and now we're the reservoir for that virus, and that's a new situation.
And Sean, I noticed today that elephants are attacking humans these days and killing them. I mean, something is very strange here. Now, they're not eating humans, but they're still killing them.
They're pretty smart beasts. I'll admit, I was in the Serengeti in 2014, and I wasn't fearful of the lions, and I'm not bothered by snakes and things, but elephants are huge, and I've been on the ground when an elephant made a little move towards us. That's a really big animal, and I think some of the problems with elephant attacks are that the elephants have been shot at a lot, and the elephants are much more wary of human contact. And so that in certain cases, is probably a reflex to poaching.
They're fighting back, aren't they?
They're very instinctual in terms of protecting their young, and they're, of course, you know, really huge animals, and if they feel threatened, they're going to make a charge.
Are we as human beings being pointed out as a food source by these beasts of burden, by these animals? I mean, are they looking at humans as their next meal?
Well, I mean, look at mosquitoes. I think that is true. I mean, mosquitoes feed on blood, and, you know, if they're living happily in the jungle and there's, you know, baboons or monkeys around, and that might be what they're feeding on. But once that jungle's knocked down, and there's lots and lots of these two-legged apes walking around, what's a mosquito going to feed on? And so we're, we join certain food chains in that way where, yes, we're the prey for these mosquitoes, but turn it around the other way. Some other diseases that have wreaked havoc in humans are because we, for example, have eaten bushmeat. That's probably one way that Ebola has been contracted, is eating bushmeat, and bushmeat is probably the original cause of AIDS jumping from chimpanzees into humans.
When you look at what has been going on this planet since the beginning of time, is the food chain really that important? I mean, shouldn't we just be living off of vegetables instead of other creatures and vice versa?
We still got to grow those vegetables, and that's tricky for 7.5 billion people.
That's true.
It takes a lot of land, and we want really, really hardy crops. And a couple of the stories I get into in the book are some of the challenges presented by growing massive amounts of crops and keeping, for example, pests off those crops. All through human history, there's been cases of famines caused by crop failure, from the Irish potato famine to, there was concern in the 60s that Asia would have such a shortage of rice that there would be massive famine. So we're always trying to come up with, more higher producing crops and techniques like fertilizers and pesticides to ensure food security. And, what's really different, George, in the last two centuries is that our population's gone from 1 billion in 1800, roughly, 2 billion in 1900, to here we are at 7.5 billion, maybe headed towards 10 billion by the middle of this century. That's a lot of people to feed. We need to use a lot of the land to do that. And we're now especially using, crops in vast areas that are pretty much all identical plants to one another. And things happen. In Asia, there's a pest known as a plant hopper that can really cause major damage to rice crops and tremendous problems with food security. So the food chain goes all the way down to plants. It does not just the big animals we got to worry about, but it's even little creatures that will eat our crops, and we got to know how to manage them.
There is some concern, Sean, and some real concern about wiping out the fish in our seas, that we're just harvesting too much. You agree with that?
Well, it's in the U.S., I can say, let me start there. There's been a high awareness for that for more than a couple of decades. And where that shows up, of course, is the fishing industry. Commercial fishing is really important, and so is recreational fishing. It's actually somewhere around about 1.7 million jobs, about $200 billion related to fishing, recreational or commercial. So the economic interest is to keep our fish stocks plentiful. And we've been managing the fisheries, whether that's freshwater or Atlantic or Pacific Ocean, I'm going to give us decent marks. There were a fair number of stocks that have been depleted over the last couple of decades. A good number of those have been rebuilt. But we're one country with a limited number of agencies responsible for that. If you go to other parts of the world, like the Mediterranean, 96% of the fish stocks are depleted in the Mediterranean, and that's the 28-country EU body that governs the Mediterranean. So when you got 28 countries around the table dealing with the same body of water, it's a lot harder than when you got one country dealing with the vast Pacific and Atlantic coastlines we have. So the fisheries are really important, but I'm gonna put another little spin of good news on it, George.
There's good news
here? Not only have we been managing pretty well, but nature is incredibly resilient. And what's been proven again and again in the fisheries is that when we relieve some of that pressure, when we, for example, close certain areas to fishing or restrict catch for a while, those areas are incredibly productive. And you can see fish populations bounce back 300-500% in just a few years. So, if you have good science, good monitoring, and good policy, and good abiding by that policy, there's a you got a decent shot at managing your fisheries, and it's a really important source of nutrition for a lot of people around the world.
It sure is. We're talking with Sean B. Carroll. His book is The Serengeti Rules. We're talking about the quest to discover how life works and why it matters. Sean, when we come back, I want to ask you about the design for all of this. It's almost like it was planned. And if it was, how was it planned? Because that is the $64,000 question. Sean's website linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. He was last with me back about 3.5 years ago as we talked about some of his other works. We'll be back. And we're with the biologist, Sean Carroll, talking about his work, the Serengeti Rules. Lots to talk with him about when we come back. We'll take your phone calls next hour as well. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with Sean B. Carroll as we talk about his book, The Serengeti Rules. Sean, who was the bright one who put together this food chain for us? Would one say it was God? I don't think it was a fluke, was it?
Well, it's really the outcome of almost 4 billion years of competition on this planet. So I know when you look at nature, you think, wow, it's so complicated in some ways, you know, so beautiful. You know, how could that just come to be? You know, the key ingredient there is time. And I think, and what is for humans, an unfathomable amount of time. We biologists can casually talk about, well, 500 million years ago, this is what was going on, and a billion years ago, this is what was going on. And we can see these things on the fossil record. But that amount of time, I mean, it's really beyond our comprehension. But if you, you know, for about the first 3 billion years of life on this planet, it was just single-celled life. It's only in the last 500 million years that things larger than that, plants and animals, evolved. And really that 500 million years has been an arms race of things getting bigger, evolving defenses like shells, and then, of course, things like claws and teeth and all that sort of thing. And that's what really gives you a more complex food chain, is that arms race of getting, you know, either bigger or tougher or able to eat other things is part of the competition. And run that race for a long time, and you've got the magnificent world we've got.
Oh, and we do. As a biologist, Sean, you, as I am, must be amazed at the complexity of life on this planet. I mean, look at all the different species on this planet. I mean, it's almost as if we hit the mother lode on this planet.
There's a great biologist, Ed Wilson, who said, you know, we were kind of lucky to evolve in this paradise, and we do have the mother load, and that's why so many people are concerned that since now there's so many of us now having an impact across the world, that we don't want to lose what we inherited. And better understanding of our impacts is really crucial to that. And that's part of the reason I wrote the book, not to be scolding or not to be, you know, doomsday-ish or anything like that. It's just to say that, you know, we've only been kind of studying nature for 50, 60 years in any deep way. And we're learning, you know, as we learn more, we've got to sort of adapt some of what we're doing.
Has the animal kingdom naturally evolved to the point where it was expected that the food chain would be there for them, that they would eat other creatures in order to survive? I mean, is that something that is inherently natural in their system?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, food is the currency in the world, right? And, you know, food to animals is what money is to humans, right? That's where all the exchange takes place, essentially, is who eats whom, and of course, plants are part of that economy as well. So, predators give rise to more predators, and grazers give rise to more grazers, and that's been going on for 500 million years.
Will it ever stop? I mean, will something go awry and it just doesn't work? It starts to collapse?
Well, that's something we start to understand now, which is it's kind of one of the virtuous parts of the system, which is take something like a predator whose prey starts to disappear. Well, that predator will shift to eating some other kind of prey. By the same token, when something that is eaten by other animals, when it starts to decline in numbers and those predators start eating something else, that's sort of the chance for that animal to start to recover. And we understand that these sort of balances, these sort of feedback loops exist all throughout nature, that things don't get eaten to the point of extinction, and they don't overwhelm the globe in their numbers. Things are sort of maintained in relatively stable numbers with respect to each other.
I got to tell you what's somewhat bizarre, too, is let's say you go to a restaurant, you order a steak, and you eat it. But if you sat there and thought about where it came from, the cow that was slaughtered, the cattle that was slaughtered for it. You kind of lose your appetite, don't you?
Well, it's a funny question to put to a biologist. I got to tell you how many times I've had dinner with ecologists and they order the prime rib.
Yeah, exactly.
And I know a good number of ecologists who are hunters as well. You know, it's you know, we've been eating meat since, you know, since our ancestors have been eating meat for a couple million years. So it is part of our diet. You know, maybe the way we do it in an industrial sort of detached way, you know, our meat just, you know, is prepared by somebody else and our hands never get dirty. That might be a little bit unusual, but certainly, you know, meat's been part of the human diet for a very, very long time. And, you know, maybe that's what I tell myself when I have a steak or a burger.
Why are there some animals, Sean, that just seem to be off limits to us, at least mentally? And I'll give you a few examples. Dogs, cats, pigeons. When you think of those creatures, maybe because we've domesticated them and they're in our families, with our families, but yeah, when you think of eating a dog or a cat, or for me, a pigeon, I just can't do it. It's nauseating to me. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, those things that we domesticated for companionship, you know, like dogs and cats, yeah, that's unthinkable to us. I think there are other creatures that maybe have, you know, adapted to urban life, as you mentioned, things like pigeons, and I can't say I would really be, you know, wild about eating squirrels or raccoons either.
Exactly.
So just the sense that these are rats, you know, things that live right around us, you know, in our kind of everyday surroundings, like, you know, like cities, you know, I don't think we just don't find those things too appealing. I don't know what instinct is kind of an operation there. You know, why would we be, you know, why are we just, can't wait to sink our teeth into a piece of salmon, but, you know, a rat nauseates us. I don't have an insight into that one, but we certainly are choosy about food.
No, you're right. I mean, the mere thought of eating a rat, can't do it. I, you know what? I'd starve to death before I ate that rat.
Yeah.
Maybe it's easier to say, but I would.
Yeah, well, you just hope that you don't get pressed into it. That's
well, we've seen what happens when people crash in planes, and the only food source is the dead victims on the plane.
That's right.
I mean,
that's right. And that's, of course, a huge taboo, and that's something deeply ingrained into us. Of course, not all of us.
Not all of us. There are some cannibals out there.
There have been cannibals. Fewer now in the world than at one point in time. But, you know, big taboo for us, that's for sure.
When you wrote the book, The Serengeti Rules, what was the big message you wanted everybody to get when they read it?
There's a lot of hidden rules, a lot of hidden connections in nature. They surprised the heck out of biologists, and I thought it was a chance in sharing these discoveries and stories about the people who made those discoveries, but it gave people a chance to see the world in a different way. If you'd like an example, most people wouldn't think that, you know, something like a wolf would influence what trees grow in a certain place.
How so?
I mean, work that out. I mean, how do you make those connections? But that's what we've now come to understand, and it's been really well studied in a place like Yellowstone National Park, where wolves were eliminated in the 1920s, and as you know, they were pretty much exterminated across a lot of North America.
In terms of by man, they were eliminated?
Yeah, we didn't like them around because we were, you know, we had... You
captured know, them, shot them, did everything like that.
Saw them as a threat. So we exterminated them. We thought, you know, we don't like these big predators around. And but biologists started to notice that in Yellowstone, you know, the stream banks were eroding. New aspen had not grown for almost seven decades in Yellowstone. And at the same time, people were saying, well, there's only one animal that, you know, is missing from sort of ancestral Yellowstone. We know that wolves used to be there. So wolves were reintroduced in 1995. And pretty soon, biologists started to notice a change in the landscape. Now, one immediate impact was the wolves, when they built up in numbers, were taking down elk, and elk numbers were declining. Well, you started to see aspen growing.
Growing back.
You saw things like willow growing. You saw cottonwood growing. And when those willow grow, they become habitat for beavers. The beavers dam those stream beds. Fish use those beaver ponds. And this is all the effect of reintroducing the wolf. And what the wolf is doing is controlling the grazers, mostly elk, but also deer, that had just been really chewing Yellowstone down to the bone. And so the presence of this top predator is really important to the landscape. And that is just, that turned biologists' minds upside down, because the thought for a long time was that kind of the world worked from the bottom up, that the plants took energy from the sun and they provided the food for the grazers, mm-hmm. and the grazers, if there were enough of them around, well, you could have a few predators around. But didn't really think that predators actually shaped the landscape. But over the last few decades, this is what biologists have discovered, that predators can have a huge impact on the landscape, both on land and, as it turns out, the seascape as well. Things like kelp forest in the Pacific Ocean is shaped by the sea otter. So this is opening our eyes to a different way of seeing the world, and then understanding that what we do as humans, now that we know there's a lot more dominoes in the chain, we got to know our impact on any particular domino.
What is the purpose for beavers to dam up water? What are they doing?
Gosh, I don't know if I know enough about beavers.
I mean, I can't believe that they're smart enough to say we need to control our water source, therefore we're damming up this lake and we can have all the water we want before the dam. I don't think they can't be that smart.
Well, they're pretty good. They're pretty industrious, right? One thing they're also doing is ensuring their food supply. So when they dam that is a water supply towards the plants that are growing in the area, and they're essentially making their own garden food.
All right.
So that's both, a lifestyle matter and a food chain matter in terms of...
Interesting. And maybe fish, accumulate at the other side of the dam because they can't go through it or something.
Well, they are creating those, but they're also creating some still areas, which, of course, some fish like, and they're also creating areas that where those fish can get out and sort of find places to hide from the bigger fish. So they're creating habitat when they do that. So in general, the effect of beavers damming natural stream areas is that they're increasing diversity. They're actually opening up habitat for more things to live.
I'm going to, when we open up our calls next hour with you, Sean, ask folks what has been the strangest thing they've eaten. I bet we're going to get all kinds of calls. But, I mean, I've known people who have eaten snake. They think it tastes like chicken, alligator. I mean, these are things. I've never tried this stuff. Have you?
I've had crocodile and alligator, farmed stuff in Australia. I eat a few things out of the ocean. I'm not sure what they were in some restaurants in Europe. But I'm not that adventurous.
I'm not sure I've eaten bison, which, of course, is, buffalo.
Well, it's yummy. That's a nice meat. So is elk.
In Japan, they call their beef Kobe beef. What does that mean?
I think Kobe is an aged beef. I think it's allowed to age for a while, and that gives it a particular, texture and taste. So
what's one of the weirdest stories, Sean, that you encountered when you're putting the book together? Something
the weirdest
that,
story?
Yeah, that's something that you just said. Oh my gosh, I can't believe this.
Yeah, I think the weirdest story I would give, just, and it's a really important one from out of agriculture, and it was kind of the one that made me slap my forehead, was, so rice, of course, is grown all over Asia. It's an incredibly important staple to so many countries, and there's this little bug called the plant hopper that started becoming a problem in the 1970s.
The plant hopper.
Plant hopper, little, by our standards, kind of a small type of grasshopper.
Okay.
And what do farmers do when they see a little grasshopper on their crops? They spray it.
They freak.
And after a few years, what was happening is they'd spray with pesticide, and the number of hoppers would go up dramatically, 100, 200-fold, and devastate the crop. Now, what the heck is going on?
Right.
Well, two things. First of all, after you've used a pesticide for a few years, the bugs are resistant.
They get that immunity.
They just kind of shrug it off, right? You'd spray it with a pesticide, it wouldn't pay any attention. The problem was the pesticide is killing spiders in the field, and the spiders are the natural control agent. So here's what you're doing. Every place is a Serengeti. It's got top predators. In those rice fields, it's the spiders. You kill the spiders, you unleash the hoppers, you ruin your crops. And I thought, that's why we need to know these Serengeti rules.
I like that. What's happening with the honeybee today?
Well, there's different ideas. I'll tell you what the lead idea of what's going on with honeybees is, you know, it's first mentioned how important they are, of course, to pollinating.
Oh, critical.
Things that are important to us. There's some thought that this is just an accident of the way we've been keeping them, is that they may be too inbred, and they become vulnerable to some either environmental agents or some sort of infection.
Or some pesticide, right?
Yeah, it could be a pesticide, but that could be something that's in the environment. That was the first thing everybody guessed, and it just hasn't panned out. So I don't think we can declare this a solved mystery, but the one concern is that we just have our bees are all too similar to each other. We need more diversity in our bee populations for them to be sort of more resilient to change. And we got to get on top of this, because that's a great example, George, again, of things we've got to understand, because there's other pollinators out there in the world. Bats can be pollinators. There's other things dispersing seeds. We need all sorts of wildlife for nature to supply our demands. So sometimes when we don't like certain creatures like bats, you know, we're acting totally against our own interest to kill them or take away their habitat or whatever, and we only find that out later.
Is there a reason for every creature, everything, Sean? Because I've always wondered, what the heck is the purpose for a mosquito? It brings disease. It obviously brings lots of disease. And, yeah, birds eat it. But what's the purpose of a mosquito?
Well, I can tell you, and then, you know, the larvae of mosquito, the frogs in ponds will scoop them up, too. Well, just everything kind of, you know, adapts to a lifestyle. It's amazing that, you know, in sort of the web of life, there's a little bit of room for almost any kind of creature. And whether you make your living drawing blood on some creature or eating something else or, the world is full of parasites. I mean, just enormous numbers of parasites. And you look at that and say, wow, that's an unfortunate thing. But that's just a reflection of just how fertile, how productive nature is, that it just generates a lot of different creatures with lots of different lifestyles, which some of us we find completely repulsive, but that's how they get by in the world.
But you're convinced every living thing on this planet, there's a reason why it's here.
Oh, sure. It's found a way of making a living. That's the way to think about it. It's kind of like all the jobs that exist in human society, that every creature in the world has found a way to make a living, and the openings, sort of the job openings in nature, get filled. That's the amazing thing. If you go into any place, like, you know, go into something as simple as a backyard pond or as complicated as a tropical jungle, and you've got all these creatures carrying out different jobs. It's amazing how specialized they can be. You know, a bug that feeds only on one kind of plant, you know, a predator that feeds on only one kind of bug. It all goes on like that. It's amazing.
And we, of course, are way up there on the chain, aren't we?
We've got our fork and knife in about every food chain on the planet.
Yeah, you got that right. Sean, stay with us. We're going to take a break and come back and discuss more with you and take some phone calls. Where do you get the book, The Serengeti Rules?
Every major bookseller is out there, certainly on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your favorite independent bookstore, wherever you can find it, it's in wide release.
Did you have fun writing this book?
I had a blast, George. It started on the Serengeti on a family trip with my whole family. An amazing, enchanting adventure, and it finished in a magical place called Gorongosa in Mozambique, which I hope we might get a chance to.
Yeah, we'll talk about the trip to Mozambique. And also, there's a chapter that says another kind of cancer. I want you to tell us a little bit about that. How that title got into this book, The Serengeti Rules. And, of course, we'll take phone calls, questions for Sean B. Carroll, of course. But also, I just want to take a little bizarre twist here. Share with us the most bizarre things you've ever eaten. Lizards? Rattlesnakes? Roadkill? Share it with us. We'll be back.